Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Walter Kern, who reads from and discusses his new novel, Mission to America, published by Doubleday. In the weeks to come, we have Lemony Snicket, Nicholas Sparks, Will Arntz, Joan Didion, Andrew Weil, Lynn Truss, Blair Underwood, Frank McCourt, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for your support. Walter Kern is one of America's toughest and best critics. He possesses a Joan Didion-like understanding of the West, and he has the ability to hilariously illuminate that world in fiction. Mr. Kern regularly takes on America in the pages of Time and the New York Times Magazine. His incisive and often controversial book reviews also appear in the New York Times on a regular basis. But tonight, Walter's with us to discuss his own work. Would you please join me in congratulating Walter Kern on the publication of his new novel, Mission to America?
Thanks a lot. You know, obviously, when you write about the American West and you write incisive criticism and all the sorts of things that he's talking about, you don't draw quite like Lemony Snicket does, who I know is going to be here soon or was maybe here last night. And I like to think that he fatigued people for readings, and parents are, you know, have spent their babysitting budget and weren't able to make it. But you know, at a certain point on a book tour, what you want to do is not so much read as vent about the bad reviews that you've gotten. So far they've been pretty positive, but this book is a sort of misunderstood book that I think only Westerners can relate to. I think the Eastern press has had a hard time with it. It's about a small community of religious, utopian sort of separatists who've isolated themselves in the mountains of Montana since about 1880, and they have in their religion a very few basic preoccupations. Number one, the health of the bowels. Now, that sounds like it was eccentric and has come in for some derision from certain reviewers, but I live in a town which is the headquarters of something called the Church Universal and Triumphant, which is itself obsessed with colonic health, and so I ripped the theme, as it were, from, you know, the front page of my local newspaper, only to have it treated in, you know, Cosmopolitan New York as some sort of rip-roaring satire. They also are not a Christian cult. They believe in all sorts of things, and I'll sort of read and give you a flavor of that. But the main thing to know about them is that they haven't been out of their Montana Valley for 150 years. They've been to Missoula for a farmer's market at which they sell some crafts, but other than that, they've stuck to the mountains. The result is that there are about 400 of them, and they all have the same eye color, are all colorblind, and are starting to develop, but, you know, twitches and other symptoms of inbreeding. So they decide it's time to get out into the big world. First of all, to bring converts back. Second of all, to find women. The two characters in the book are called Mason Laverle and his partner, Elder Stark. They set out with $600 apiece, which they believe should last them 9 months, a green Dodge camper van to bring America to its senses. The thing that they know that the rest of the country doesn't know is that all unhappiness comes from and all anxiety from comparing what you have with what you might have, what you used to have, what others have. They don't do that. This is a very happy, very serene, optimistic group of people who get by gratefully with whatever the day presents them. They set out down the highway, and I'll sort of read a few snatches from their progress and then a bit of a longer one toward the end. But when I'm reading out west, I like to start with one that discusses Wyoming and its ugliness. I'll give you a quick summary of their beliefs first. "We were the Aboriginal fulfilled apostles, and I am Mason Plato Laverle. I won't start by recounting all of our history. It will trickle out. We approved, that's the main thing. We approved abundantly. We approved of the Prince of Flocks, whom others call Christ, and of our God of Gods, the All-in-One. But we also approved of a host of other divinities, majestic and humble, familiar and obscure, from tricky old Coyote, the Hopi Spirit, to dainty Lady Vegetalis, a garden sylph of cloudy origins. We approved of diverse ideas and teachings as well, embracing the Golden Rule, the Ten Commandments, the Hindu law of karma, and our very own perpetuity of essence, which was easy to state but hard to comprehend. In the words of the seeress, our aging leader, death does not end us, birth does not begin us, and life does not corrupt us. We stream on forever through the etheric flux, indestructible channels of vitality." So with this, you know, very benevolent and lovely philosophy, accepting of all faiths and of all teachings, they come into an America which they're shocked to find is full of anti-abortion posters next to the roadside, Christian preachers on the radio, etc., etc. And the irony, I guess, is that they come to save a world which is saved 10 times over and, you know, believes it knows everything and is more religious in a sense than they are. So, as I say, first they get to Wyoming. And if I can find the right passage, this is good on the podcast, the sound of flipping pages. "Central Wyoming was like hell without the flames, an underworld thrust up onto the surface. Treeless gray gravel pit mountains, dry silt riverbeds, dump trucks heaped with mine tailings and slag, lethargically pumping gas rigs, crumbling buttes, and expanses of dead, abrasive-looking grass crisscrossed by sagging barbed wire with tufts of hair in it. There was no color anywhere but in the sky, and a lot of the time no color in the sky, just a uniform high layer of linty clouds that bled all the happy light out of the sun. A lot of Montana was plain and arid, too, but Wyoming was punishment for having eyes. Even the roadkill was uglier. In Montana, the deer on the shoulders of the roads lay there intact and peaceful, with long, curved backs. But here their bodies were blown apart in chunks." Now, as they drive through central Wyoming, you know, there's not a lot to see and thus not a lot to talk about. And one of the sort of abiding paradoxes of life in the West, for me at least, is why gophers and prairie dogs wait until your car is 15 feet away to cross the freeway. I think it's a great metaphor for the self-destructive impulse in all of us, what Freud called the death wish, because you'd think that on the plains of, you know, central Wyoming, the only thing that a prairie dog would see would be your approaching car, and yet it seems to be the only thing they don't see. And they time their death so perfectly that you can only imagine that there is a flaw in Darwinism. Unfortunately, it doesn't point to intelligent design, but to moronic design. So anyway, they're having a hard time meeting people. They've got their Payless shoes on and their white shirts and so on. And they stop at a Dairy Queen-like restaurant outside of Casper, Wyoming. And they see a few girls sitting there. At a tippy aluminum table across the aisle from us, four teenage girls in belly-bearing T-shirts were picking at an enormous paper-lined basket of fried potato fingers glopped with iridescent yellow cheese. Now, it's important to remember that for these guys, junk food represents just the absolute decimation of all they believe in. I mean, they believe that you should go to the bathroom four times a day. You know, that in some religions it might be that you are a virgin or I don't know, of perfect carriage and stature or something. But status in this cult has to do with how clean your colon is. So. But they've fallen afoul almost immediately of that. The one guy's already addicted to buffalo wings and Dr. Pepper. So their flimsy plastic combination spoon forks could only stab up a finger at a time. The girl who appeared to be the leader, the tallest and prettiest with the lightest hair, nodded at Elder Stark's dish of swirled white ice cream. "You know there's no actual dairy in that," she said. "It's totally animal fat whipped up with air." "Sweetie Freeze is ice milk," Elder Stark said. He was an expert now. He knew his treats. "Well, let it sit for 10 minutes if you don't believe me. The stuff doesn't melt. It's lard." The other girls nodded. "Never eat Jell-O either. It's made from cow's hooves." "We're vegetarians," said another girl. "What are you two?" I tried a joke. "We're starving." I've never been good at jokes. They wilt on me. I feel them wilting even before they start to, and it changes my voice a little, which hastens the wilting. "Jehovah's Witnesses," the top girl said. "Seventh-dayers? Seventh-dayers are hot." "Because they watch their weight," another girl said. "They're way into fitness. They don't snarf lard for lunch." The tips of Elder Stark's earlobes pulsed bright red as he set down a spoonful of chocolate sauce and pineapple. During our training course, I'd heard it said that after his father left his family, he developed a temper and was sent for a summer to El Dorado Farm, the church's disciplinary youth retreat, where troublesome boys built fences, tore them down, and put them back up in the same place. "You tell us first, what are you?" I asked the girls. "We're Wiccans. We worship nature," one said. "How?" "We run around nude in the woods," the same girl said, "nude and completely shaved." Her girlfriends cackled. The top girl looked angry and shushed them by pointing her spoon fork. At the table behind theirs, an old brown woman looked up from the job application she was working on. From the moment I'd noticed what she was doing and how earnest and strenuous she seemed, I'd been feeling anxious on her behalf. "Bethany's still a novice," the top girl said. "She hasn't learned respect yet. Excuse her language." "It's her imagery, not her language," my partner said. The top girl ate a cheesy finger. She fascinated me. I couldn't stop staring at her lipsticked mouth, at the perfect alignment between its wet red corners and the corners of her pumpkin seed-shaped eyes, brownly outlined in pencil and bluely shadowed. Apostle girls used makeup, too, but without any flair or conviction to mask their flaws. This girl, though, was a master of lavish effects beyond those required for basic facial smoothness. She belonged in a tent in a land across the sea, an amusement for warlords gathered around a fire. Looking at her, I sensed for the first time that my return to Bluff, that's the name of the town they're from, was not assured, or at least not my happy, safe return. "And don't try to tell us that Wicca is Satanism," said a girl who hadn't spoken yet. "We get that from our pastor, and it's BS. Anything that empowers women, he hates. He knows that the planet's alive and that it's female, and he knows that Jehovah is just some masculine fear god the Jews stole from the Persians to keep their wives in line. Read archaeology. Read history." "We don't have any dispute with that," I told her. Now, the other thing that's important about this sect these guys come from is that it's entirely matriarchal. The men are like drones, worker bees. It's run by women entirely. "We don't have any dispute with that," I told her. In fact, Mother Lucy had made quite similar points back in the early 1880s. The difference was that the Wiccans of the Sweetie Freeze were stern and resentful, while the first female apostles were glad and buoyant. Could we correct these prickly girls? It felt to me unlikely. They were just children, children who wore paint, spraying big foggy ideas in people's faces to make the people wince and hold their noses. They weren't whatever that thing was they'd just called themselves. They were bouncy, flip-tailed little skunks. Now, Mason, disgusted, walks out into the parking lot. Now, they have a system for looking for people who might be potential converts, and this is it. I rose from the table and threw away my Sunday cup, aware that my partner intended to stay and scrimmage. I'd tracked a few dozen windshields in the parking lot, which also served a drugstore and a supermarket. We'd worked out a system for using our shrinking tracked supply to what we hoped was good advantage. The system worked off the appearance of the vehicles. Dented ones and damaged ones, if the damage appeared recent and the cars looked new and costly, were the ones we tracked first. Our reasoning was that their owners were shaken people who'd thought that handsome purchases would spare them the reversals and disappointments that people here seemed so paralyzed about. We wanted to hit them while they were still bewildered. Next were very old, miniature, dusty cars with lots of belongings crammed in their back seats, and ideally lots of stuck-on decals whose messages and sayings didn't quite harmonize. The best example we'd found so far was a tiny Chevrolet that we knew wasn't manufactured anymore, full of pillows and laundry and camping gear, whose driver was eager to push the following three sentiments. A duck may be somebody's mother, back off, asshole, and ask me about the life zone path to health. What made such people so promising, we felt, was that they were so obviously confused, yet also it struck us striving not to be. So this Mason has grown disgusted with these girls. The partner, however, has grown deeply enchanted with them, and the result is that they accept an invitation to a party at their house. And they drive out into the dark outskirts of Casper. If you've ever been there, you can't make any place darker in the West than the outskirts of Casper. I mean, the downtown is bad enough. Anyway, so the top girl did have parents, as it came out. They just weren't in town that night, she said. They'd driven to Denver with friends to see a concert. Of what sort of music, the top girl wasn't sure, although I guessed from looking around the home, constructed from two identical chipboard half-homes whose joint was visible in the stucco ceiling as a long, yellow, splotchy line of water damage, that it wasn't the opera or one of the great choirs. The parents did appreciate their art, though. They'd hung it everywhere, on all their walls. Photographically accurate paintings of Indian chiefs, misty sky scenes of migrating white geese, and above the toaster a barbed wire Jesus cross with a whittled twig Jesus glued to a barnwood plank. The art collection was reaching, in its way, towards some whispery, spacious statement about courage, or maybe grief, or gratitude. Whatever the broad intent, it touched my bosom. Art, art of any kind, shows that folks are trying. The top girl, named Sherry, and her followers, after some phone calls, the tribe had grown to six, were heating a pan of dark broth that they believed would grant them the power of invisibility, which they'd promised to demonstrate for us if we came home with them. Elder Stark had said, "Lead on," for both of us, and tried to convince me in the van as we followed the Pontiac up a cracked state highway marred by swooping, scary-looking skid marks that might have been the results of vain attempts to spare the lives of death-intent small beasts, that tonight was our chance to begin our mission in earnest. "We've let ourselves get too inner, too snailed up," he said. "The people who cross our trail, it's for a reason." "You had a prompt," I said. "I have them all the time." He rubbed his nose, which was red and drippy suddenly, and cleared his sinuses by loudly snuffling, though apostles are taught that it's preferable to blow. "You bought that old man's drug," I said. "They were just in a truck stop, and somebody came up offering to sell them methamphetamine, and because they're so polite, they, of course, took some, and they understand it to be an anti-hunger drug. So he says, you bought that old man's drug. He didn't deny a single word. You eat ice lard for supper, and now you're some sad drug crook. Illumined all in one, my partner said, as if he was setting out to really pray. But that was as far as he took it. Pretty weak. Well, how much did you pay? Not half of what it's worth. I feel like my head is finally the right size. I feel like it finally fits around my mind. Does that squeeze ever bother you, that lack of skull space? Does it feel like it's wearing off, I said. I damned well hope not. The Wiccan girls set out barbecue potato chips and opened a case of room-temperature beer that Elder Stark and I declined in favor of glasses of tap water with lemon slices. My partner did accept a cigarette, though, taking advantage of conflicting teachings on tobacco use, which Little Red Elk permitted for special ceremonies, but Mother Lucy had abhorred. He stood in the doorway, exhaling complex blue clouds into the orange radiance of a bug light mounted on a pole beside the steps, and talked fancy doctrine with Sherry's sister, Carly, a thin brunette whose disfiguringly large breasts caused her to keep her arms crossed and hump her back. "Who's trying this with me? Volunteers?" asked Sherry. She held out the hot pan with padded oven mitts, and two of the girls bent over to sniff the broth, which had pine needles floating on top and smelled like drain mold. One girl backed away, but another got a coffee cup, dipped it half full, and raised it to her lips. She couldn't quite do it, though. She poured it back. "Come on, all you chicken shit witches," Sherry said. "Yucky. I tried it last Friday. It's someone else's turn. I have to go pick up my stepdad from drunk driving class." Everyone but Sherry had some excuse. She, though, partook directly from the pan, tilting it back until nothing was left but grit. Afterward, she joined me on the sofa, where I'd turned on a show about two fashion models who'd been forced to survive in the Arctic for a month, eating seal fat and sleeping in army tents. They love reality TV, these two. They can't get enough of it. I was glad to have TV again. Its shapes and colors changed faster than those in nature and seemed to reach a deep layer inside my eyes that had gone unused since I was born. "It takes a minute. You don't just vanish," said Sherry. "Also, the moon might not be right tonight. Ideally, you want it either new or full." "Your parents aren't Wiccans," I said. "They're Prince of Flocks types." I caught my old habit then. "Christ Jesus folks." "Well, that cross by the toaster, it was there when we moved in. They're actually nothing, just, you know, fun and money people. My dad works on oil rigs, murdering the earth, and Katrina, my stepmom, really she's just dad's girlfriend. Maybe they're legally married, but I doubt it. She came here one night for a threesome with my real mom, but then when my dad liked her better, my real mom left. We hear she deals a pie gal poker in Reno now. She just sits in the kitchen drinking Cokes all day and blows my dad's paychecks calling psychic hotlines. Like anything's ever going to change for her until she loses 30 pounds and waxes. But you think there's more to life, don't you? I sure wish. That wishing part of you, I said, try to keep it a certain size. I'm not saying go get rid of it. Just keep it walking. Don't let it gallop and buck and toss you off. Then Mason explains about the seeress who leads the church and tells her that one of the teachings that the seeress propounds is that people shouldn't wish for things, they should be happy with things. Sherry's not really happy with that answer, and so she asks some more questions. "Well, what does the seeress think about the Bible?" "Which one?" I said. Sherry came to believe I'd told a joke, but it took a minute, and when she laughed, it took me a minute to know why she was laughing, because she thought I'd been funny, obviously. The problem was that I couldn't remember how by then, or even precisely what I'd said. Things had gone very pleasant, though, with the two of us. "Well, what about sin and redemption and all that?" she said. "The serpent? You mean the serpent? Well, that's where it starts, I guess." "What does?" "Evil." "Why? Which one of the evils? You mean the Follies? They don't believe in evil either, this group." "Just explain it, okay? Don't make me poke around." "I didn't mean to do that. I hate that too. Like when somebody smiles just to make you ask how come." Then Mason says, I think I just realized what Bible you meant back there. Here's the tale on that one. They wrote it backwards using opposites. Original sin, it's original redemption. That's the way it used to read, at least, before they had to put it into code. You know why they did that? I'll tell you. I believe you. You don't want the reason behind it? I don't need one. It's a cool, weird idea, and it's neat you think it's true. Well, good. Okay. Can I tell you something, Sherry? What? She said. That was a pleasant gesture there. I like it when young women just believe me. We drifted in across the sofa by then, drawn toward a mushy low spot in its center where the springs had given out. Not once had she looked away while I was speaking, and by the time I thanked her, our legs were touching. Not with pressure, but lightly, thoughtlessly, like the legs of two schoolmates sitting on a bench. Having never held someone's attention so thoroughly, nor felt it being offered to me so freely, I wasn't prepared for the tenderness it roused. A mission didn't have to feel like work. Sherry let go of a question she'd been holding. If you're saying there's nothing wrong with us? Uh-huh. Then why does it feel so fucked up? Comparison. I'm this. You're that. I'm tall. That makes you short. It doesn't make you anything at all, though. Unless you have a stake in false esteeming, like maybe you think you're the prettiest in town, and you think if you're going to stay the prettiest, that's a fair trade for believing that you're short. That's how it operates. It's a marketplace. I'll be the strongest so you can be the smartest. And on and on and on and round and round. Sherry didn't look like she understood me. I get it, she said. And it's cool, but why is it bad? It sounds like it kind of works out for everyone. Not for the ugliest, I said. It doesn't work out for the girl who's stuck with that one, or the dirtiest, or the biggest nincompoop, or fish mouth and pig butt. I know, it's really sick still, and I'm not being mean here or stuck up. There aren't a lot of those people, the bottom types. It's horrible, sure, and grotesque and sad and everything, but it's just the price we have to pay. One or two fish mouths, 100 Cinderellas, I'll be big pig butt, you can all be. I'm out of examples here. You give me one, something lots of people love to be. So did Christ have to die? It sounds like maybe not. Why does a Wiccan care? What are you, anyway? I live in Wyoming. A lot of people care here. I have to talk to them every day at school. Can I maybe finish up on my thing first, on why it's not just bad because of fish mouth, even though that's really pretty bad? I want you to. Go ahead. I'd like some beer now. Apostles drink sometimes. I'm parched. I'm dry. Well, maybe instead of a beer, you'd rather kiss me. Get your mouth wet that way. Maybe so. So go ahead and try. What's stopping you? First, there was the matter of Sherry's youth. Because I'd seen her drive a car, I guessed that she had to be at least 16, but age was hard to judge here, and I was antsy. Young women in Bluff could be dated by their hairstyles, bobs and pigtails until they reached 11, bangs and ponytails until 15 or so, and then a stretch of growing their hair out long until after the frolic when they tied it up, not letting it down again until they married, when they tended to experiment a little before their children came. Here, though, everything was flexible. I'd seen 30-year-olds who dressed like they were 12 in cheap plastic sandals and T-shirts much too small for them. I'd also seen 12-year-olds who wore dark glasses and carried credit cards and leather purses with clasps and hinges that could have been true gold. Sherry held out one hand and said, I'm shimmering. That's how it starts. If you slit your eyes, you'll see it. She rested the hand, palm up, on my left knee, and though its cross-hatched lines were indistinct, showing perhaps that her life would not be long, the lifelines in my palms were not so promising either, the rest of the hand looked as solid as before. Do you have a girlfriend back home? I did, not now. You shouldn't buy shoes made of vinyl. I have determined that. You're sweet, said Sherry. I like your thoughts, your games. That one you tried when we first sat down together, being short at first, then rising taller. Now, they've been trained in Anthony Robbins-like neuro-linguistic salesmanship. the whole reason they're on this mission is that one of the members in Bluff strayed outside of the town and got cast in a reality TV show that was like a sort of strongman contest. He won $500,000 and went around to business audiences promoting the Aboriginal apostle way of life, and came back having learned how to sort of hypnotize people with language and, you know, do strange things when you shake their hands. And these guys try all these tricks. Anyway, my partner and Carly stepped in from the porch and joined the other girls at the kitchen table, where they were reading one another's tarot cards by the light of a stout red cookie-scented candle left over from some festive day, no doubt. He pulled up a galvanized trash can for a chair and said to the card reader, "Do mine next. I need one." Given who his mother was, he probably already understood his fortune and intended to discredit Wiccanism by comparing his mother's predictions with the girl's. "Do you still want to kiss me? Remember, I'm a Wiccan." "You'd be more invisible by now." "Your call," said Sherry. "Your call. Your fall." Half an hour later, in Sherry's parents' bedroom, where most of the art involved circuses and whales, a powerful light beam washed the windows white. "The neighborhood watch," said Sherry. "Just ignore it." I couldn't ignore it, though. Too near, too bright. I put myself back in my pants, re-zipped the fly, and sat up against the pillows in a position that made things look more formal, as though we'd merely reconvened our spirit talk in slightly softer, quieter surroundings. Through the wall, I could hear Elder Stark and Sherry's sister discussing geofibrillation, a theory propounded by the seeress concerning slight hiccups in the Earth's rotation that led to various civil wars and such. The topic had first arisen at the tarot session and had absorbed Elder Stark and Carly so fully that the other girls had left the party. The flashlight beam raked us again, then swung away. I watched its white circle trail across the yard, bringing out the texture of the grass, and then climb the side of a house across the way whose blinds were drawn but whose lights were all flared on. "He's a registered sex offender," Sherry said. "That's why they bug him. He's cured, though. Got the surgery. All he does is eat pot brownies now and role-play on the web. His gaming name used to be Grodel, but now it's Frantis. At least it was Frantis last month when I was Xyla and I fucking zworked him in the zone. I neutralized his last Mixadrill with urine." This was fierce, deep Wicca. Beyond far Neptune. This was Andromeda business, and not for me. I wondered what tarot deck these people used. Who are the figures? I knew they weren't the old ones. Sherry rested a cheek on my bare stomach and gazed up at me across my chest, whose muscles looked thicker than normal from my angle. I liked the whole picture, everything about it, and I wished that Sherry had shushed before the Mixadrill. I petted the side of her head. I pitied her. The outskirts of Casper weren't the place for her, or for anyone, it seemed to me. I decided the neighbor had drawn her into zworking by slumping along the walks here, looking hangdog about how lonely and shunned he felt and how he didn't deserve the surgery. They certainly did have their laws out here. Oh, boy. She must have heard me thinking this. "If I was older, I'd make you take me with you. I hate it here. I hate my shitty friends. I hate doing spells. I hate my dad's fat girlfriend. I wish I was off in college in some nicer state where trees have leaves, you know, with squirrels in them." "It won't be long," I said. "To me, it feels like forever." My stomach soured. A plume of acid rose and bit my throat. "How old are you, Sherry?" 15. 15 last week. 16 would have been kinder on my gastric pipes. 15 burned. 15 last week burned holes. Something sizzled inside me, my pancreas, I thought. Sometimes I was able to feel it. My mother taught me. "You drive a car, though." "Oh, that's Mike's from across the way, Castration Man's. I'm his sweetie. He lets me borrow it. I sent away for a pretty great fake license. He says it's not fair that I'm stuck here when my folks split, and plus he has the bracelet until Thanksgiving. He can't really drive until then unless it's medical. I buy his groceries. I pick up his prescriptions. Sometimes he flips me a monster oxycodone." I looked down across my muscles at Cherry's face, which had suddenly lost its close to grown-up architecture. It was a moon now, full behind thin clouds, and though, like the moon, you could see it as a person, its features formed no fixed pattern in themselves. Whatever young ladiness I'd seen in her, I must have added for my own purposes. Now that mask was misting off. Even her skin, regarded honestly, seen with cold and legal eyes, not lust's whatever-I-need-here eyes, looked wetly plump and nursery fresh. And the harder I stared, the more babyish it got. Not only the skin, but the entire specimen, until its young freshness flipped over into ancientness, and I was alone in a bad Wyoming bedroom with some kind of flippery, sunless jelly porpoise that had just finned its way up onto the sand. "I'm leaving," I said. This was gallant in such a place. "Don't. I want you to teach me. I'll leave some books. I saw you with your phone. It has a number." "Don't think that way, Sherry. So write it on my arm here." My floating mind, my prompter, saved me then. "No books," it commanded. "Your number is in those books." "You can't even fly, but you always try," she said. I interpreted this as grudging, odd Wiccan permission to organize for a few seconds before I bolted. As I buttoned my shirt and pocketed my tie, Sherry lay on her back in her slivery black crotch strip and sleeveless half t-shirt with the dancing elephant and stretched out her arms so her fingers touched the headboard. "Look how long I am. I'm a tree," she said. "I'm 1,000 feet tall, with roots and limbs and buds. I draw up the waters and bear them to the sky." I opened the door to the hall and looked around for Carly and my partner. They'd gone off. I heard Wiccan love music playing, low and churning. I turned back to Sherry, who was sitting up now, brushing her hair out with her back to me as though facing a beauty mirror that wasn't there. "The worst thing is that you upset the woodland balance. The stag hath had its pleasure and its romp, while the doe receiveth naught." She pointed her hairbrush handle at the window. "Look at that," she said. "You seeing that?" I couldn't, because Sherry blocked my view. I hoped her scripture voice had had its say. This notion that I'd romped was overdone. I'd scampered some, but so had she. She'd scampered all over me, in fact. "The neighborhood watch guy has taken down your license plate. I hope he didn't peek inside my room and see your buddy with my little sister." The word "little" overburdened my mind. Somehow I managed to fashion a departure by calling forth an immensely peaceful memory of standing in a buffet line at a church lunch, loading my paper plate with 3-bean salad. Everyone was there, my entire town, my family, even the seeress, propped up in her wheelchair, drinking red punch from a yellow paper cup. I was young, maybe 10, and was wearing a clip-on bow tie. My pockets were heavy with interesting rocks I'd found. I was back in the van when I let the memory pass. My partner was at the wheel. We'd made it out. I seemed to recall him opening his wallet and putting money into Carly's palm as a sort of panicky last courtesy. Or maybe she and Cherry had required it. They'd been Andromeda's children at the end there, nothing Wiccan about them. Elder Stark's stance, after we were free and set to be free of Wyoming in 2 hours, was that we should have known they'd change, and that in many ways we had known, especially once they'd pursued invisibility. Since I hadn't recovered enough for a debate yet, I let my partner's side be the only side, whether it was true or not. I had to admit, though, that if he'd argued a different side, I would have taken it myself. Now, as soon as they get out of Wyoming, and I wrote this book chiefly because I met a woman from Steamboat Springs, Colorado, a couple of years ago, and have made the drive a lot of times between Montana and there. That's how I know how awful central Wyoming is, especially Rawlins, and how I got them out of probably the worst kind of place you could be, the outskirts of Casper to one of the wonderful, tiny, jewel-like paradises of the West, Steamboat Springs, which I, for legal reasons, actually for no reason, recalled, renamed Snowshoe Springs. That's what makes it fiction. Anyway, so there are a couple people here tonight from Steamboat, and I just wanted to read a short description of their town to them, in case growing up there wasn't enough to tell them what it's like. As we rode through the streets in the morning, we waved at people, especially the younger women, and once in a while one of them smiled back at us. Most of the women struck us as remote, though. Their faces were hard and wind-burned. They carried water bottles. Their calves showed carpentered edges as they walked, and their throat muscles shifted sharply when they spoke, as if separately manufacturing each word. It was hard to imagine them pregnant, though many were. The fetuses rode up high in firm, round capsules that gave the impression of being detachable from their mother's bodies, like the seats that unhooked from the mighty eight-wheeled strollers they stuck the kids into after they were born so that they could be carried into restaurants and stowed beneath the tables. I guess that's women, not Steamboat Springs. It's really a book about women. He meets one, finished with the sort of system by which Mason picks out his potential mate. He goes to a health food store to hear a lecture on liver health, thinking that he'll meet like-minded people there. The liver lecture, as I'd expected, confirmed my beliefs about thistle tea. I barely listened. I watched the audience, ranking the women according to a system I'd been working out since age 16 or so. I noted the looseness or tightness of their hairstyles, which I'd found to be an indicator of a woman's overall disposition. Tight-haired women tended, from what I'd seen, to be more patient, more yielding, and better listeners. They let a man express himself and seemed to gain feelings of security from a firm and confident approach. Loose-haired women, though, shrank away from forcefulness. They came off as warm and spontaneous at first, but in the end they lacked the inner discipline, the stable structures of instinct and belief that would allow a man to seize and hold them. From the tight-haired women in the audience, the users of clips, barrettes, and rubber bands, I picked out two who looked around my age and monitored their behavior during the talk. The taller and darker of the pair dwelt mostly in her spinal column. When the lecturer grew animated or made a stimulating point, she raised her shoulders to separate her vertebrae. When his words were dull, she hunched, bore down, driving her energy toward her pelvic cradle. According to the Book of Osteograms, Mother Lucy's posthumously published treatise on the spiritual aspects of physiognomy, this woman was a verticalist expanded and leaned towards stubbornness and practicality. In romantic terms, she matched best with men of the radialist balanced family, whose well-developed shoulders and stout hips marked them as cheerful, rational, and steadfast. This meant she wasn't the woman for me. My grandmother, a devoted student of osteograms, had classified me when I was just an infant as a localist unpatterned, meaning that my animating essence roamed freely through my skeleton and predisposed me to indecision, compassion, dependency, and disorganization. I wasn't told any of this until age 12, but I sensed it well before then. The other girl I was eyeing, petite but womanly, her hair clamped in place by a mousetrap-sized black clip studded with rhinestones, was difficult to analyze. She was sitting one row ahead of me at the end, wearing tall lace-up boots of lightly scuffed brown leather, tight dark blue jeans tucked into the boots, and a fitted tweed jacket with nothing underneath it but a shiny lace-fringed off-white slip that showed the deep freckled crevice between her breasts. The small of her back curved so far inward that I wondered if she was doing some sort of exercise, and her legs made up close to two-thirds of her height. Her essence appeared to be centered in her hind parts. So this girl, who turns out to be an internet model of lingerie, rubber lingerie, becomes for Mason his ideal mate. He pursues her in Steamboat Springs. He becomes the prisoner of a billionaire buffalo rancher who has made his money torturing monkeys in offshore laboratories while testing shampoos and drugs on their skin. And these two guys sort of move deeper, more deeply into this kind of modern Colorado that I, as a Montanan who visit here only briefly, consider to be, you know, a total zoo. I mean, Montana, we have a kind of even dispersed population. Here in Colorado, where I've set my last two books and probably will set my next, there's enough drama to, you know, write out another 150 pages. I hope you enjoy the book if you should choose to read it, and I'm very grateful that you came. If anybody has a question or, you know, a remark, feel free. Yeah. Writers like me who write books which are neither outrageously, exaggeratedly funny nor seriously and intellectually dark fall in a strange place in American culture. You know, I think I see life pretty much as it exists, as a blend of absurdity and pathos, you know, nobility and foolishness. But it's better if you're a writer to choose one and push it to the max. And so you get your David Foster Wallace's who believe the world is made up of, you know, binary computer data somehow lodged in human beings' heads. Or you get Nicholas Sparks writing about lost love and, you know, what it's like to meet again after 30 years and you're both in wheelchairs. And because I put all those characters in my books, I hit no special target audience. A book like Thumbsucker, which was an autobiographical story about my own unfortunate thumbsucking habit, which I did not write with the notion it would be turned into a movie, or with the notion that I would have to sit next to my mother watching the movie, was a book that had a very ferocious and loyal and small audience. I think the same can probably be said of the movie. I think a lot of people saw this movie, which I loved, and didn't know what to make it. Is it a comedy? Is it some sort of sad family tale? Is it a, you know, coming of age teen flick? So as long as I refuse to classify myself, I think I probably limit my fame some, except in Salt Lake City, where as a former Mormon, I can expect crowds of hundreds of people merely by showing up because they're so interested that I could criticize or be skeptical about the Mormon church for the last 15 years and still be alive and allowed to roam free that they have to actually come and see me. So the cusp of fame, I think, will always move one step ahead of Walter Kern. How he got to be a critical thinker, able to see his people from a distance. Your suggestion is that it represents a flaw in the conception of the book, that people are, you know, when they grow up rather isolated and so on, unable to see their group from the outside. Well, you wouldn't pick him to evangelize. No, I think the person that picks him to evangelize has an ulterior motive and also sort of thinks better of it halfway through. You know, Mason does, to his credit, know something about the outside world, and that knowledge comes from a half-complete set of Trivial Pursuit cards that he found in a dumpster when he was a teenager and went out in the woods and memorized. So he does know, you know, the crucial things about American culture, you know, who Cher is, and a few other things. That's not as important as it used to be, but you know, I, to be honest, and to be really bluntly honest as a writer, when you write from the point of view of someone who's somewhat innocent and sheltered, you have a choice. You can either emphasize in their character that sort of ungainly, awkward, ignorant and innocent side, or you can tease out their observant, acute side. Now, I think people are born with one or the other temperament along a spectrum, and I chose a somewhat more acute character. He could have been a sort of bumbling, you know, completely orthodox, naive seeker who, you know, says wow and gee whiz at everything he sees, and he does to a certain extent. But you know, in some ways, what this book challenged me to do was capture the culture of the 19th century, a kind of utopian, mystical, optimistic, communitarian culture that often moved these small religious movements, seal it in time, and then release it in the world of Home Depot and, you know, huge real estate speculation on the edge of ski towns and coal bed methane exploration in the middle of Wyoming. I mean, I didn't bring a Martian to Earth. What I brought, in a way, was an American or a person from our culture who exists, who comes an emissary from an earlier stage of our development. And I would argue from a more interesting stage of our development. Religion in the 19th century was a fertile, mystical, alive, exploratory thing. You know, Mary Todd Lincoln would go to seances in the White House. If somebody went to a seance in the White House now, Dr. James Dobson would personally come in a helicopter and fire artillery through the window, you know, and demand that the U.S. Constitution be rescinded. You know, these were characters who, in a sense, gave us the New Age. And before the 20th century came along and brutalized everyone, polarized them, pushed them to their corners, we had a sense in this country that anything was possible. I mean, it was religious folks who gave us free love, not, you know, I mean, it was the Shakers and the various 19th century sort of optimistic sects that gave us free love and open marriage and all those things that we think of as products of the 60s. And the religious culture nowadays exists as this kind of stentorian, rock-ribbed, horrible, condemnatory commandment cult, you know, whereas in these days they were sort of like, you know, trying to hear the spirits and eat the right foods and purify their ethereal minds and so on. All that's gone the way of, you know, the horse and buggy, and we exist nowadays in this sort of like club-wielding warfare in which some people have declared themselves fundamentalists and everyone else secularists, which no one who is a secularist thought he was until he was named such. And yet, you know, we're forced to bear the label. So these guys come from a period before all that, and they come to our period with what I believe to be an actual message of some usefulness and hope. And will they be destroyed by Cheetos, I guess, is the suspense in the whole thing. But no, I mean, he is an acute and observant character, but he comes from a culture which is actually fairly rich. He's not an Amish guy. He hasn't been denied books or anything like that. And, you know, it's like these homeschoolers who end up running, you know, they win the geography bee, they win the spelling bee, and yet they never were out of the backyard of their house in Idaho somehow. You know, I think that these sort of incestuous small little groups sometimes yield up, you know, very bright minds, and certainly very observant minds. Most challenging was synthesizing a sort of what I found to be, you know, this book has been treated as satire by a lot of critics, especially metropolitan critics, and that's really the only kind there are nowadays, except for me, who lives in Livingston, Montana, and writes for the New York Times. But I found most challenging coming up with a belief system that was historically true to the kind of religious movements that existed in the late 19th century, but one which at the same time represented that which I found kind of acceptable, honorable, and inspiring in spiritual thought generally. So I had to kind of come up with a convincing antique as far as that went. It's for you to judge how convincing it is. But and then bringing that into a particular person's consciousness and training that consciousness on the world at large was very difficult, because I did not want the book to fall into the humor of, look, cell phones, or, you know, it's amazing, this internet thing, come try it. There's a little of that, only because whenever anyone experiences novelty, they notice it. But what is really anachronistic about these guys is not their inability to comprehend technology or anything like that, but their temperament, their sense of serenity. You know, the country now runs on the engines of dissatisfaction and anxiety, which are stoked 24 hours a day with as much energy as possible by the best minds of Madison Avenue, Hollywood, Washington, and everywhere else. These are guys who come from a world in which the opposite was being done. You know, the United States was still existing as a detached, isolated island of tranquility compared to the rest of the world. Yeah, we had the Civil War, but that settled. It seemed like we could sort of have a happy existence away from the wars and the strife and so on. Well, the 20th century turned everything upside down and turned us into a culture of people who are perpetually upset. You look at the town names from back then, Harmony, you know, Bountiful, et cetera, et cetera. We would never call anything that nowadays. You know, if we were naming new towns nowadays, we'd call it something, you know, Hot Rock City or, I don't know, Sexy Valley, or Silicon Valley, or whatever. So, as I say, I think the hardest part was taking a temperament that doesn't really exist anymore and putting it here and keeping it authentic without making a complete joke out of it. I would like, see, this is the part that, and some of the reception and criticism of the book has seen this clearly, and some of it hasn't. I would like to present to this world a couple of characters and a point of view which I believe challenges the reigning one, because and which I think should cause us to wonder, do we need to be as we are? Do we need to think and feel as we do? And do we need to go on building this completely unsustainable edifice bound to crumble both spiritually, socially, and physically that we seem intent on constructing? I mean, these guys are, you know, little puppies on the crowded freeway of life, and they do get run over several times in the book. But it really wasn't a sincere attempt to reconstruct a kind of innocence, a kind of benevolence, and a kind of communitarian mind that I think we have a lot to learn from. Though nobody listens to them in the book, they have something to say, and novelists don't usually do this. They don't side with any of their characters. It's life's great feast, but I had a lot of sympathy and a lot of compassion and identity with these characters I created, and I did it in the hopes of throwing up a challenge to the world as it is constituted around us right now. I mean, we could use a mission to America. We are so busy right now bringing democracy to the Middle East, prosperity to, you know, the places that don't have it, Christianity to the communist darkness of China, this and that. No one is coming to us, and if they did, we'd never listen. I mean, America seems to be a place now in which all the answers have been collected, perfected, and classified, and its job is simply to disperse them throughout the world until they get it through their damn thick heads that we're right, they're wrong, and we can all be happy once we agree. Well,
this is not a place that is growing in wisdom once it's reached that conclusion. And so, since no one from France will probably be allowed to come in and preach to us, and we're not going to listen to anyone who has anything to do with the Far East, I created two characters out of the sort of clay of the American past to ask a few questions of the system as it exists. No, I don't. They don't know who I'm satirizing, and then that goes back to my earlier point. When you don't declare yourself either a humorist or a sort of bona fide, politicized intellectual, people don't know what to make of you. And people read this book, and I've heard they say it's a satire of fundamentalism. Well, these guys couldn't be less fundamentalist. They're appalled by fundamentalism. Then they say it's all just a satire of consumerism. Well, it's not that either. I mean, these guys are as delighted as, you know, I was when I was a kid with a lot of the neat things we have out here. It is simply a sort of description of the world as it stands from the point of view of someone who's not of it. And, and it's really a book more than anything for Westerners and about the West. The same thing that propelled Brigham Young to come and populate a valley, a dry valley in Utah, or drove people to... I just heard about a place in Colorado today called Sunrise, which is up by Loveland, which is peopled by a New Age group called the Emissary of Light, I believe. And they've sort of, they're frozen in time in the 40s. They said they're frozen in time in the 80s, actually, somebody said. They were founded in the 40s. They sort of reached their peak in the 80s, and they haven't advanced since. Now, in 40 years, that's going to be an interesting group to examine. They'll still be listening to Bon Jovi, and, they'll have computers, but they'll be huge, with no flat screens. I'd like to take some of the Emissaries of Light and put them out in the world of 2090 and see what happens. But in any case, that same spirit that drove people west and to set up a lot of these sort of utopian and religious communities is the one that's driving these very, very rich people to buy 40,000-acre ranches and stock them with private wolf packs and buffalo herds. They want to be left alone. They want to recreate some harmony that they believe was lost. The environmental movement of today shares a lot of qualities with the religious movements of the past, in that they both seek to sort of restore and live in a lost balance. And so I think the West continues to be a place where people are actively seeking refuge and trying to recreate paradise. And in this book, as I said, it sort of ends up set on a huge ranch owned by a billionaire. You have that past paradise seeking that sort of motivated the Mormons, let's say, and this current one, which motivates the Ted Turners. Mm-hmm. And they're brought into conflict. But it's not a rigged game. It's two things that exist. And what frustrates me about being reviewed in New York is that people think you're making up some outlandish fictional scenario when you have one man own 40,000 acres. Oh, please. Or, a buffalo herd that somebody just bought? Oh, come on. Or, religious types who hide out in the mountains? I mean, I came to Montana because I was sent to cover that Church Universal Triumphant when they thought the world was going to end. And the realistic scene in front of me was of 2,000 people who thought they were going to spend 7 years underground and therefore charged their credit cards to the max, thinking they would never have to pay them, and charged them up buying things like 7 years' supplies of tampons. Now, just writing that straight is one of the most hilarious things you could do. They literally had, there was a guy with a Ryder truck whose job was to go around the three-state area buying all the feminine napkins and toilet paper that he could find. And, I write that straight. Well, if I write it, and everybody goes, but if I write it in a novel, they think that it's the most preposterous, contrived, fictional scenario ever, you know. So writing about the West is difficult for a national audience. It really is, more so than I had imagined, because I've lived in New York too. They think I'm telling fairy tales. Youth growing up in religion. Up in the Air, which is my previous novel, which for people who haven't read it, is set in the Denver airport mostly, because it was my feeling that airports had replaced cities as, you know, the places where people actually lived. Was a book about a kind of a business consultant who has no home. He just lives in, like, the club lounges and the Marriotts and, you know, the first class cabins of the world. And if you think of that character, and grows to enjoy them, he's probably the most retarded psychological and emotional specimen I've ever written about. I mean, though I think in the book I give him the nominal age of 35, he's about 11 in his soul. So, but he's the oldest character I've written about, because I'm dealing with a great lag time in my own experience, you know. Inside and in my soul, I feel like I'm about 27 and I've just about caught up to it in fiction. I don't know. I admire writers who can write about characters older than themselves, because I have no idea what I might learn by the time I'm that age. So, but also I think that fiction writers, they burn the wood stacked closest to the door first. And the wood stacked closest to the door is your own biography and your own memories. And I've pretty much burned it all twice. And so I think in this book and in Up in the Air, I sort of had to voyage out into the forest and forage for twigs and, you know, into the world. I'm drawing further away from myself as a subject and going out and actually seeing what's going on. Thanks for coming. You're the few, the proud, and the very much appreciated.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for Lemony Snicket, Nicholas Sparks, Will Arntz, Joan Didion, Andrew Weil, Lynn Truss, Blair Underwood, Frank McCourt, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on October 27th, 2005.